Thank you, Rob, and I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and really organizing such a nice event. I'm enjoying it a lot. And well, the title says Helicity and Other Topological Invariants of Flows, and there were previously Renzo talked about helicity, I believe, and he asked me actually the other day whether I know a nice or short proof of helicity invariance. So what is helicity? I'll explain it in a talk what helicity is, but it's a certain conserved quantity in a fluid flow which happens to have a topological meaning. And topological meaning comes from the linking number. So link comes from actually linking number of orbits of the flow. So I want to sort of present, so I thought it would be maybe good to do some basic computations and present two points of view or two types of derivations for invariance. And maybe I'll set up sort of a fairly general stage. So suppose we have some vector field. On some domain, well, usually for simplicity, I think it's going to be R3 or maybe a 3-sphere if I want something compact. But most of the time, if I'm in a setting of 3-space, my vector field will be compactly supported, or at least integrable in some sense. Integrable, I mean the norm of the vector field. It's an integrable function on a domain. And I'll denote by phi v a flow. The flow. And in general, I will allow v to be time dependent. But it's easier to do computations when v is actually time independent. So I'll maybe do some derivations in the case we have an independent vector field. So now the way we should think about it, so we have some v here. So we look at trajectories, right, orbits. And we put some object, maybe like a curve, at some point, and then I flow it for some time, and I get, well, topologically equivalent object, but perhaps deformed. And now we want to measure some quantity associated with this object. So I want to assign a certain real number here, and somehow measure, I'm interested sort of invariant quantities related to the object I inserted into the flow, and see, well, how can I obtain those? So let's, so this OT is just an image of O0, initial object by time t, after time t. So how do I measure, how do I associate a real number with something? Well, if it's a curve, a convenient way to do it is to actually integrate something called differential form over a curve. So the next object we have on the top of this is eta is some differential form, which depends on the dimension of my object. So if I'm a curve, then this is going to be one form. And for those of you maybe not very familiar with differential forms, an example, if I, for instance, want to compute a circulation along, if O0 is a curve and I compute circulation, then I'll take eta to be, so suppose I have some coordinates here, x, y, z. Then simply what I can do, so the one form, it's a vector, but in this case, I associate a one form which is really coming from a vector field itself. So I can look at integral at time t of this eta. It's a real number. Well, it's something, right? And I may ask if it's a conserved quantity. Similarly, I can just put a surface here, right? And put a two form on the top of my domain and ask if I choose the right two form, whether I get a conserved quantity this way. So when is this something like this conserved? Well, we'll just have to differentiate this, right? And ask if the time derivative is zero, conserved under the evolution. And this, if you compute this just using, you know, limit calculus limit definition of the derivative, at time maybe zero, at time t, that's what you can see. Well, I extract something. What I can do now to make this integral over the same curve, I can just use flow to change the variables, right, or pull back the form to the initial curve. This is a curve after time t plus h. So I'm going to pull back, change variables to be at time t. And I can put limit under the integral then. So essentially, I reduce the problem to this computation becomes eta. And what is the time of the flow? Well, I have to sort of put minus h here to kind of get back in time and subtract h. And this infinitesimal quantity is called, this limit is called the lead derivative of eta along the flow. So what I get out of this, this is just a definition, right? So I call something like this lead derivative of eta along the flow. This you can put any tensor here, actually. I mean, if you want to work with tensors. So this tells me something like this, right? Well, and if this vanishes, of course, right? This vanishes, and then I'm conserved. And this principle essentially guides invariance of several things.
So in your example, if you have a background metric, I guess this is just the B bracket B paired with the metric, right?
So this is just the same as taking just an Euclidean inner product and inserting a vector into first, so in the first coordinate, right? And then I have still space for the second vector. So this, in this case, it becomes essentially a bracket. Well, so it vanishes, right? So this is right. So in this case, what we get here, or should I write it? Right. So this is proportional to the bracket of V with V, which is zero. So this is zero in this case. If let me see that. Well, it's not quite that. It's not zero, right?
Is that magic, the derivative of the one form with respect to V?
Yes, yes. Well, right, so this is not the same as, because you have a metric tensor there, right? So,
oh, that's a homework.
So let's see. So actually, it will follow that. Yeah, that might be a little homework there. But actually, so in the regime of Euler equations, we'll see that it is invariant. So in the case, this quantity also varies with time, right? then eta itself is time dependent, then this calculation reduces to, there's an extra term there. So if I differentiate this, we get at time t, we also get a partial derivative with respect to time, and then v eta, right? So I think what I'm talking about, if for physicists, this is just a different setting of a material derivative. But I'm not very comfortable with material derivatives, so that's why I'm presenting it this way. So if I look at, so the basic example is of the situation you're interested in is when vector field is actually a solution to the Euler equations. So suppose v is a velocity field of a fluid, right? And it's in ideal fluid. Then, if I look at such a form, then you can rewrite. Of course, you can write Euler equations in terms of the velocity field. But I can also write them in terms of this one form. So take a contract the vector field into the Euclidean inner product, and then you can write these equations as follows. So if you look at time derivative of my one form, then it is actually equal to the Lie derivative minus Lie derivative of the one form along the vector field minus a certain gradient. This is like a gradient of a function, and the function is where the function is pressure minus half of the magnitude of V squared. So, but if now sort of connection to this becomes obvious. So if you put this on the other side, then you see that this one form, there's an eta here, this one form is just exact. But if you're integrating over a closed curve, right, then this just goes away. So this is called Calvin's circulation theorem, right?
So what's the pressure in this setting?
Well, it's just, no, I'm just taking the ideal Euler equations. And there's just our general pressure.
I understand that, but I mean, from a mathematical viewpoint, what's the relationship between P and D?
Well, this is just some function of. There's no. I don't make any assumptions. Just some scalar-valued function. So this is essentially these two arrows imply that if I look at some closed curve in this fluid flow, and this is effectively circulation, is constant in time. Right. So as I said, it's a Calvin's theorem. Okay, so let's switch. And you can actually take, for instance, you can derive flux conservation this way as well. How do I derive flux conservation? This maybe demonstrates sort of power of differential forms, if you will. Well, there is another way to associate differential form to a vector field. Well, you can just, and I'm going to do this actually shortly a lot. So not, another example is consider maybe beta, which is uh, which is a two form, essentially obtained by taking the determinant of a field. So it's going to be a bilinear form, which eats two vectors, but already has prescribed third vector, column vector, and takes a determinant of the resulting matrix. The way to write it in the differential form notation is just that I'm inserting vector field in mu, which is the volume form of R3. So here, mu is just dx wedge dy wedge dz. And what happens to this when I look at this Lie derivative of this beta along the flow? Well, you can easily derive that this is actually zero due to something called Cartan's formula. So if the vector field is divergence 3. So what happens here? Actually, this goes away. Right, this goes away, 0. And the reason is because if I have two parallel vectors in a determinant, it just vanishes. And this part just becomes divergence of a vector field, V, times beta. So if the divergence is zero, this again, you can see the flux is a conserved quantity because, well, if you integrate this over a surface with some boundary, right, and you push it along, then. So we derive flux conservation this way as well. So let's see where is helicity. So let's turn our attention to ideal magnetohydrodynamics. I guess I could stick to Euler equations as well. But maybe it's a little easier to actually think about magnetic fields rather than vorticity. So a search for a conserved quantity in ideal MHD. So I just look at ideal MHD and, well, I disregard part of the equations and just focus on this part. And again, there is a way to write down everything in terms of Lie derivatives. So here, what is B? B is a magnetic field. V is some velocity field. All fields are time dependent. And B at some initial time is an initial vector field B0. And divergences are 0. So the divergence of the magnetic field is 0, and the divergence of the driving velocity field is 0 as well. But this almost immediately looks like there should be some kind of conserved quantity there. So again, it is helpful. What is this? It's just a Lie bracket, this Lie derivative. Again, the definition is exactly the same. Infinitesimal definition is a limit. Infinitesimal limit is you push forward vector field via epsilon and take a limit. So this is what you get here. And sometimes maybe you write it as, I believe, curl of the same, curl of a cross product of V and B, right? So I like to work with differential forms. So let's look at this beta. Beta is, again, just I put in a one slot of a determinant, I put my vector field, right? A magnetic field in this case. And from this derivation, I can see actually that what we say the form is closed if the divergence of the underlying field is zero, right? So in this case, it's a closed form, i.e., if I take a differential, it vanished.
This is the star eta. It's the same as the star eta.
Right, right. If you can take star eta if you like, right? I want star would be one more piece of notation, which I don't want to. Well, I try to reduce, maybe. It's not obvious, but. So what does it mean? Let's just look at. So essentially, what I'm after is looking at this material derivative of this differential form along the flow, because if I integrate some appropriate dimensional object against it, right, I'm going to get a conserved quantity. So let's compute this. This again, everything here is time dependent. Let's compute this. Well, of course, I have certain relation to this equation. Looks almost the same, but there is a slight difference here. Well, this is a form. This is a field, right? Vector field. So what happens? Well, if you differentiate, you just have to remember how this is defined. So if I differentiate respect to time, what I get? I just get time derivative of B inserted into mu, right? And then I go farther. I have to use few algebraic properties of the Lie derivative. Actually, there is a Leibniz rule here. So what is I have to expand this piece here, and I can use the Leibniz rule in the following way that it behaves nicely with respect to this so-called contraction. I get the derivative of V plus IB Lie derivative along V of mu. This is what happens to this. Well, this is just a bracket. I already noticed that here. And this turns out to be divergence of V times mu. So at the end of the day, what you get out of this is certain identity, which is essentially equivalent to the original equations. You can kind of go both ways here. So let me denote there is this bracket, the time derivative and the divergence times B. And if this is conserved, right, I mean strongly conserved in a sense, then you get you want this to be zero, which is equivalent to saying that this vector field is zero. Well, if it's divergence 3, then if you make this extra assumption, it's equivalent to this equation. So what we get out of this is essentially we get back. Get back this, if we equate it to zero. So that's what happens. We provided this. Okay. So how can I now? If I have a divergence free field, then of course I could integrate something two-dimensional here, right, and get a conserved quantity. This magnetic form, I could integrate against some surface sitting in the velocity flow, velocity field. But of course, I would like to get something slightly different, but yes, there's a question there.
Well, I just wanted to check exactly which ingredients are required in order to get this conceptual.
This is actually if and only if.
In some sense, you have two vector fields which are divergence free.
Yes.
And you associate the one of them with conserved two form. Presumably, you need everything here, right? We need both of the vector fields are divergence free.
Right, because.
Ideal.
Let's see. So did I. That's right.
I mean, one could imagine, you know, yes, I have these two vector fields, V and B, and I can always construct this two-form associated to B, exactly right. As you've done, and it seems to be...
Did you use the divergence of B here at all?
Yeah.
Right. Divergence of B?
Yeah.
Whether it vanishes? Yeah, I'm trying to see that. Let's see. Actually,
this B could be a closed form.
This is just embedded here, right? But in this derivation itself, right? I haven't used it. Well, I just used the fact that the divergence of the velocity field is zero. So this equation is equivalent to this if the divergence of V is zero. So it does not use divergence of B at all.
So,
but here is what I'm going to do. So let's use the fact that we are on a three space. So here's my beta is this, and I'm on a three space, or S3. And I know now I'm going to use the divergence free condition, because that's required for, it comes out to be helicity. So since DB is zero, right, it's a closed form. So it means that because I'm in this simply connected spaces, means that it's exact. Or if you don't like this, in this case, it just means that B is a curl of something, some other field. So this just says that beta is, if you want to switch back to differential forms, it's a D differential of some form, right? And where alpha, you take A has components A1, A2, A3, right? So then I choose, there are two ways to represent a field as a form, either one form or two form, as we saw. So I choose a one form representation in this case.
This is
a two connectedness, right? Which is on manifold equivalent to one connectedness. Okay. So, and this is a divergence free condition here. So if I look what this does to alpha now, well, we see I know what it does to beta if V is divergence 3. I know what it does to beta, but on beta is 0, right? But beta is now D alpha, and you can, what these operators commute with D, you can pull this in front of all this. So what you get is that D of applied to alpha now is 0. So it's again some closed form. So in particular, I'm on R3 again, it has to be exact, or it has to have a potential. I mean, maybe that's a better language. So it's D of some function this time. So it's just a gradient. So what happens if I wedge these two things? So it means like take a cross product, or in some sense, or really what I'm going to do, I'm going to take a dot product. So then it's again just a product formula that look at beta wedge alpha. What is this? Well, if you just work it out again using coordinates, you want to get A dot product B times this volume form mu, which is just dx wedge dy wedge dz. So it's an inner product times inner product of these two fields times the volume 4. And if you do this, this is again, there's a Leibniz rule. This is like a product. You can do the Leibniz rule to this wedge. And what you get out of this is, well, just combine all these equations, you get D of this potential little f of gradient times B. So this is exact. Or if you will, it has a potential again. So now if I integrate it over some this has an advantage of being a free form. So I can integrate it against a three-dimensional object, like a ball sitting in a fluid, right? Or something else. Possibly it has a boundary. And I try to see if I'm conserved. If I integrate this against on my domain, commoving domain with the fluid, whether it's preserved. And of course, it is. Well, there's this differential here. Okay, I'm going too slow. So now introduce, I'm going to call it H of B. Take some omega and integrate this. Maybe call it omega zero. So essentially what I'm doing, I'm integrating an inner product. Of course, this integral has to make sense. So I better be integrable. Or if B has compact support, or, and there is a special case here, if I make an extra assumption that B is tangent to the boundary of this region, right? It's tangent to the boundary of this region, then if I look at this infinitesimal rate of change, of course, what I get under the integral is this lead derivative of the wedge product, right, at some t. And what happens here is effectively I'm integrating, after this computation, a differential of f times beta, right? So now beta, this is a Stokes theorem, which tells me I'm the same as an integral on the boundary of f. But you see this assumption of B parallel to boundary means that if I restrict beta, it's the same as saying if beta restricted to the boundary, it just vanishes. So this goes away. So I'm conserved if my field is tangent, if my magnetic field is tangent to my blob, right? So this conserved quantity, I guess first has been discovered by Volcher. And 58. So yes, Ransom can correct me here. And later used by Moffat, 1969, and Arnold, 74. So this is like the older story. It's called helicity of beta of B. Of course, if I don't have boundary, like I'm on the entire S3, then I'm automatically don't have this last step, so I'm zero. Yeah, that's right. If you I'm on a homology sphere, right? So this, where is topology here? It looks like, and this proof which I presented is essentially, you can just do this purely in the language of vector fields. And I think first Volcher, I checked this before this talk. So Volcher had some proof, and Moffat essentially in the appendix of his paper gives this type of a proof, except that he doesn't use differential forms. And then, of course, what Arnold says about this, as we'll see, will imply invariance of this quantity as well. So why is this useful? So where is topology here? So Moffat first observed that there is some connection to topology. Well, maybe I should actually kind of work it out starting from this identity. You can write it, of course, as this is kind of like taking inverse of a curl on B and taking a dot product B with B. So this operator, this inverse of curl, it's actually a nice compact L2 operator, and it has a green function. So if you write this in terms of the green function, this potential, then what you get is an integral in terms of omega 0 of the following. So here I need some coordinates. And that's going to be, so I have to kind of work with a product of two domains on, and I have two copies of those, and I have to have y cross product x minus y. So I have to integrate, say, over respect to y. So if you combine these things together, something, put this integral here, it looks like there is a linking, something like linking number floating around. And I believe this is what Moffat used in his 69 paper. Showed the following, not a special case, we would call it a special case, but a certain situation where, just look at sort of a vector field built on the hop link. So think about omega as being just this union of these two curves. Of course, I'm thinking about this, actually, of these two cubes. So make it thicker. And you have some beta, vector field beta outside. And in particular, of course, defined on these two tubes as well. And you assume that these tubes are invariant set for the vector field. So vector field is tangent to the tubes. So you can really restrict it to two pieces. You have B1 here and perhaps B2. But it's all maybe just a restriction. Suppose your vector field has such a structure sitting inside. Then if you just restrict this computation to this omega 0, to kind of look at the helicity of beta restricted to omega. So this is the theorem of Moffat. What you get is a linking number of these core curves, C1, C2, times fluxes of B1 times flux B2. So fluxes through these cross-sectional disks. And now it's clear that, of course, as B evolves, so if you start pushing B, if you will, so B evolves according to this ideal magnetohydrodynamics equation. So if you look at B in time, this structure sits there, right? And this, of course, linking number doesn't change, and fluxes are, as we showed, are conserved. So this is a conserved quantity. So the helicity, at least restricted to these two tubes, is never going to vanish if they're linked.
For this, what are you assuming? No, being that it's
just like tangent.
Duration or something like this.
No, actually, you don't have to. So I think Moffat used certain assumed that there may be parallel curves inside. But in general, you don't have to assume anything. I mean, this is now, after Arnold's technology, and fields inside can be anything, can be chaotic. I mean, as long as they're tangent to the boundary.
And it's always this.
Yes.
At the time, there were just two curves, two thin lines.
At the time, I guess, when he thought about this was just he made the model that, that these fields inside are just parallel circles. I mean, they have orbits which are parallel circles, more or less.
Uh-huh.
So then it's.
So you need to assume that the orbits are parallel.
No, you don't need to assume that. Right now, you don't need to assume. I'm just if you were in the 1969, you I guess if I'm not mistaken.
At the time, there was no structure.
Right.
Just field lines, and he didn't think of any structure in these tubes at all.
They prove something more general.
Right. So that's what I'm getting heading to. So then I think we switch to Arnold's perspective, and which explains your question.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I noticed you write Moffat with one T, is two.
I'm sorry,
because it's been consistent. So.
And it was when you wrote by the airport, the slightly different spelling is E and one T. And
yes.
They couldn't tell about that.
So what is the relevance of this? I mean, why would you care about this? Maybe before I start, and that's Arnold again. Well, it turns out, let's just compute it. But I guess it's take an absolute value of this helicity, right? So this is the way to write it. If you think about this expression here, well, that's just an absolute value of an L2 inner product. I'm just going to use two here, of these two fields. And turns out that this inverse, this we see, I mean, it's an L2, it's actually a compact operator on L2, has a green function. Yes.
So you were looking at the helicity restricted to this domain,
right?
Omega, not the tubes.
Right.
But the helicity, the integrand is not a sign, so if you get.
Well, the fields have orientation, right?
Okay. I'm sorry if there's some kind of domain monotonicity. Okay.
Well, I'm not sure what. I don't think there is. For eigenfields of vector fields, there's no domain monotonicity. But what is this? I mean, this is just L2 norm of this inverse curl. And now you get B times B, L2 norm of B times B. So you get a square of an L2 norm. This is, you can compute it actually. This is equal to an L2 norm of an operator. One, it's a self-adjoint, nice self-adjoint operator. It's a reciprocal of a first eigenvalue of the curl. Because, I mean, curl itself is a differential. So there's some constant here which measures the norm. And this, well, this is just an integral of the magnitude of the field squared, right? So this is just an energy. So we see that this quantity, all this stays actually invariant under, if I start deforming this field by volume preserving deformations, right? By this velocity field, this changes in time. So in time, this is the same as h at b0. So it's just constant, right? So if this energy ought to be relaxed to zero, that's what what physicists say, that in the process this energy is decreases. Then of course, if I have such a structure like Moffat described in the field, that I cannot decrease it because this is always on zero. And that's where prompted Arnold's question. Well, is there? This is nice. It provides a lower bound for the field energy. Is there a way to cook up other invariants which are topological in this sense, which also provide lower bounds? And it's easy to see that cases where helicity fails to be non-zero. And a classical example is, I guess, even also due to Moffat, I think, originally. Well, just take Borromean triple linking. Take something like Borromean rings and make them into tubes, and put in the tubes, put nice parallel fields inside of the tubes, and now if you write down helicity for this domain, helicity is just zero if these are parallel fields inside. This comes from the fact that the pairwise linking number, if you apply this formula, pairwise linking numbers vanish. But of course, topologists know how to detect this. This is one of the oldest invariants of Milner says, well, take spanning disk, ciphered surfaces, and look at the triple intersection point, and look at the sign. So however you deform this, you look at the right ciphered surfaces, which you can always find. Then you can just count triple intersection numbers with sign. And that's sort of a third order linking, right? So can you do something with higher? So the philosophical question is, can you do something with higher order invariants for knots and links to still produce invariants or vector fields? And hopefully also produce energy bounds, right? And I think it's in Arnold and Cassin book, it's called a dream to produce such a hierarchy of invariants where ordinary helicity vanishes, then there is a higher invariant which does not vanish, and sort of in order for energy to be relaxed, you have to have all these invariants vanishing. So here's now this topological perspective. It's have been farther developed by Arnold in his 74 paper.
And here's what
and this actually is a little bit more than just. It also provides certain philosophy to produce these higher invariants I'm talking about. So Arnold, and then probably 74. So here's a perspective. Let's recall what the linking number is first. Linking number of two closed curves. So I have S1 going to R3, and the second one also going, say, to R3. If they're linked, then maybe linked or unlinked, but I can look at the intersection of their images. They cannot intersect, and the curve are they're individual embeddings. Then what can I do then? One way to think about linking number is, well, look at FL. Maybe I call it link L. And what I'm going to do, I'm to look at a product of these two maps from a circle to R3, and effectively get a map from a two torus to R3 cross R3. But actually, since I'm not allowing these curves to touch each other, I'm allowed to use points of coincidence, which is the diagonal, right? So this is just described by x equal y. So if this is an x coordinate, this is a y coordinate, that can remove this set. This is called configuration space of two points in R3. So now what happens, of course, if I'm allowing to, I want to have something which is invariant, so I want to allow to deform these links. But as I'm deforming them, I'm deforming this product map. So the map is defined as follows. Take TS, coordinates on the torus, and assign just the simplest possible thing. I mean, put one parameterization in one coordinate and second parameterization in the second coordinate. That's what this is. And as I'm deforming this curve, I'm deforming this map. So actually, I may deform up to something called homotopy, right? Completely continuous deformation. And I may ask myself, in language of topology, I would be asking if this map represents something non-trivial among homotopy classes of maps from this torus to this configuration space, right? So the question is, I kind of look at the class associated with this, with maps to this configuration space. I'm asking if I have a non-trivial map here. If I do, then by definition, I mean, this is a classes of things which can be obtained by deformations, then whatever, if I can characterize, give an integer value to this object, then I have an invariant, right? Well, fortunately here, this space is fairly straightforward. I mean, you can see it's actually equivalent up to change of variables to R3 cross R3 minus the origin. And the way to realize it, take x comma y and send it to x comma x minus y, right? Then of course the second coordinate can never be zero because you remove the coincidence set or the diagonal, if you will. And now you see, I mean, if I allow to homotopically deform this space, this is just a two sphere because this is contractible completely. I mean, homotopy to a point, this is homotopy to a two sphere. So really, this is not such a bad creature. This is just a two sphere. I can replace it with a two sphere. And you ask a topologist, I mean, what is this set? The formation classes of such maps.
Well, it's a copy of integers.
How? Well, take a map and assign a degree of this map. Right? So, how many times the map wraps the two torus around the two sphere?
So you're just talking about the Calligaryonic theorem,
yes. Essentially, yes.
Yes.
I guess I'm not sure if
you already had a discussion about that.
Right, so it's a Gauss linking formula. But from the point of view of, say, somebody who does homotopy theory, so this is a copy of integers, and it turns out, of course, if I have two curves which are linked like this, the map is degree one, so it associates one. And you may think about taking this one component, winding several times, you'll get a kth degree map, right? And then it's not hard to see, actually, that you just count crossings. Positive crossings, and that's what you really do. So what is good? Where is the formula here? So there's a nice way to compute the degree. And again, you look at maybe some differential geometry book, and so let's look at the degree of this map associated to the link, which is a product map. Then we know it's a degree formula. You can just integrate over this two torus, which is the domain of the map, some two form, which is pulled back from this two sphere. So you take an area form, a two form, which measures area on a two sphere, and you change variables. So you go to a torus, and you have a two-dimensional form, you can torus to dimension two, you can integrate to get a number, right? So up to some scale here, I don't know, two pi or something, 4 pi, this is an integer, right? But so here's an idea. What is this omega? Omega eats two vectors, x and y, at a point, and spits out something like this. X, well, I'm just going to use this notation, triple product notation. This is on R3, so this is a nicely defined two form on R3 minus 0, which restricts to an area form on a two sphere. So if you restrict this to S2, then you get an area form. So I'm doing all this because I want to convey a certain idea here. Now go back to vector fields. Now look at the vector field. So I have some vector field in my domain. So I'm thinking magnetic field, really. And I look at, I'm going to fix two points in my domain. I'm going to look at trajectories. So after time t, of course, my flow takes me somewhere, right? So I'm looking at the flow of b after time t and see what it does to the initial point x here. And also do the same thing with some other point. And I can flow like this, tracing a curves, right? Well, at each point, of course, I also have a tangent vector, b here. B. So I can actually, now, these are of course not closed curves, so I'm going to compensate for that for doing the following. After some time t, my notation is a little bit bad. I'm going to put b as a superscript. I'm going to essentially close this up to the initial point by a straight line, or a geodesic, if you will. So I didn't go so far here, so my curve is not very interesting. But as I go farther in time, they actually get more and more linked, right? And I close this up, I get more and more complicated links as time goes to infinity. But here's what I'm going to think about. I'm going to take this omega, which is a form on R3 minus the origin. I'm going to think about this as a form on a configuration space. So let be a form on this deleted product, if you will. So now I can produce a function on this configuration space out of this form. So produce a function as follows. It's going to be a function associated to the vector field. And at any two points, they're just going to do something simple. Take omega. How is this form on here? Well, I can write down a formula for it. This is exactly then the Gauss linking form. If you write down in coordinates x and y, you're going to get x minus y cubed. Of course, one slot, x minus y. If you write down in coordinates. But now I have two slots, right? I can insert my vector field in each of them, but of course, in one slot I think about this as a vector field of an x variable, and the other slot is a vector field of y variable. So what I'm gonna do this. And if I write down this again in coordinates, I would be just doing the following. Right, and just compute this like this. But that's a function, it's a scalar function, right? Well, except the diagonal is tricky. I mean, maybe it blows up, maybe not. It probably blows up, right? So it's not a well-defined function on the product, but on a deleted product. But now if I observe something, if you integrate this function, just restrict this function to these two curves, traced and closed, which are closed up after some time, right? This gives you, the integral of this function will give you a linking number of pairs of those curves. So now, linking number, if I think about this, I call these curves closed up curves. This is an integral over a product. This is really effectively computing the degree, right? Which I mentioned earlier. T and x and y. So this depends on point. This will depend on pair of points where I do it, and also on time, right? So, but essentially, I'm just integrating some function here, restricted to these things. And of course, I have to parameterize. You have a parameter by the flow. So maybe I should, okay. How should I do it? Okay, let me do it this way, correctly. 0 to t, and then phi b t x, phi b t y, and then of course the I'm sorry, there's a little t here and a little s, dt wedge ds. But of course I have to close this up, so this is not, I have to still add something which comes from these geodesics plus short paths. So why not do the following? And here's an theorem of Arnold. So this kind of measures progressive linking as you go with the flow. You want to get rid of the time dependence. So, well, it's a nice function. This looks just like time average of this function over the flow, this part, right? So just take time average and ask if the limit exists, if it's a function, right? So define a time average just as a limit of this as t goes to infinity. You have to take a correct scaling here, average in the right way. And because you have a pair action of a R2 by volume preserving diffeomorphism, this is these flows, because you have two parameters, you have to average by the area of your, which is t square, right? And then you just take, up there there's this linking number of these two things, which is this time average. And this depends on pairs of points. So now if you use L1, and this was actually Vogel's contribution, I think 03 or something like this, use L1 ergodic theorem, which will say, well, that this time averages, this as a function, right? You take this limit, exists almost everywhere. And at the end of the day, you actually get this function is defines almost, not almost everywhere, but it's also integrable. So.
What was the Vogel contribution?
So he showed actually that it's L1 on, I guess, configurations. Vogel's contribution is that he observed that you can use L1 ergodic theorem. And the whole, what is the proof now? Of course, ergodic theorem tells you that this is nice, but he showed the short paths go to zero because you have to divide them by this contribution is integrals over piece times something, right?
Okay, and before him?
Before him, the Birkhoff ergodic theorem, Arnold was trying to use Birkhoff, and then I believe there were problems with these short paths going to zero unless they were so-called uniformly bounded. But it was more a problem of a pointwise convergence. And if you just, but here, can you just convergence in an L1 sense to something? And what does the ergodic theorem tells you? So L1 ergodic theorem tells us that integral of this invariant function. So you have to prove something here. You have to prove that this contribution from the short path segments is not meaningful. It goes to zero as time goes to infinity. He showed that if you integrate this is an invariant function under the flow, right? So this is a time average. It's actually equal to the original space average, if you will. So there's a B here and B here. And that just says that this just says this formula. See, on one side, you have just usual Arnold's helicity, because this was, if you work this out this using this formula, you just get a usual Arnold's helicity of a vector field B. Wolcher's helicity. And on this side, it's an integral of a certain time average. And this is called, rightfully, the asymptotic linking number, this function, or asymptotic linking number function. So this is what comes under the integral here, which tells that the average asymptotic linking number equals to the original helicity. And now this is with this, it's easy to show that if you have anything whatsoever inside of the tubes, it doesn't have to be nice parallel or anything, it makes sense. And the formula makes sense, right? Maybe there are other ways, but at least this provides a way. Another output of this...
This asymptotic linking number doesn't depend on specific dynamics inside the tube, it's totally independent.
This is just the fact that these two, if there are some fluxes and zero fluxes, right? It's completely independent. If you can, you can further expand this formula, and Renzo, I think, with Keith Moffat have a paper where they analyze what happens when you look at the self-linkings of tubes themselves. And then what you get is essentially this Carganov writhe plus twist. So if you look, if the field inside more or less twists around its core on average, then this twist coefficient is what you can call the linking number.
That's so, assuming that the field is, say, nice, right?
Yeah.
But that's assuming the field is nice.
The field could be chaotic, could be any complicated and structure, and it's always the same number.
That's always the same number.
And furthermore, here, are we safe in saying that there is no assumption on lines to be closed? That indeed, you should.
No, that's the Vogel's contribution, that you can use actually essentially so-called any short path system. Doesn't have to be straight lines, but as long as they satisfy, for instance, you can take geodesics and push them forward by diffeomorphies. You get something not geodesic, but this is still a good short path system to connect things. This is formal step to sort of see this connection that these. So in some sense, it's forming some. This is a topological link to the definition of the linking number. But the last point I want to make here is that there is a little bit more in this. So initially, so here's there's a lot more in this than meets the eye. I don't know. Maybe it's obvious, or maybe nobody has written this down. If you take this vector field B and you look at some other vector field B after some time t, so you push for, you evolve it, right? So initial vector field B zero, and suppose you have some link there. Well, I'm gonna just maybe draw something like this, and then there is an evolved link, and it's not necessarily closed up. I'm just drawing it closed up. I'm running out of time, but I want to just sort of finish this. So this came, essentially what happens here, you can write it that this is initial field, and this other field has been obtained by pushing the, by sort of pushing this other field, initial field B, by a flow of a velocity field. That's what happened here. So now you want to use this fact to show that the helicity is invariant, right? So what does this do? I mean, these trajectories are not necessarily closed. They could go to infinity somehow. You have this short path system here. And you also have, you can use a push forward short path system, as I said, by a diffeomorphism. And now what you leak, well, what happens to this, thanks to this, I'm integrating effectively this time average, right? So you see, if you want to compare helicities, you compare what happens before an, the initial stage and an after stage. But of course, the linking number, so you look at linking numbers of like trajectories of B and the linking numbers of trajectory push forward B, or B after time T. But this numerator does not change if you use the push forward short path system, right? So this pointwise limit stay the same of almost everywhere. So you derive the following identity, that if you look at this function over there, this invariant function of B is 0 at x, y equals, because this is just a deformation, can use the deformation of a link. This is just an invariant function of a push forward field after some any time t, B0. At, of course, you have to compute it at right point. So you also have to look at images of axes. So you get following identity almost everywhere. And of course, if you integrate this, you get a helicity of B0 on this side. You have helicity of this BT on this side, but now this is a change of variables here by a volume preserving deformation. So change of variables does not change the volume form, so you get the same integrals. So this directly implies that helicity of B0 field is the same as helicity of BT field, which is another way to see the invariance. right? Other than, so initially I just had this long derivation using differential forms. And here's a kind of a topological argument. So of course you can try to, maybe I'll just say one sentence and then stop. The whole idea is there's a philosophy behind it, right? Take a knot invariant, maybe a signature of a single knot or some other link invariant, and try to repeat the procedure in a sense that try to take some kind of averages of this invariant in time of long orbits. If you are succeeded in, if you have a success in showing that this limit converges almost everywhere and it's an L1 integrable function, you have an associated invariant of a vector field, right? Under ideal magnetohydrodynamics, just kind of following this procedure. And so I myself have some work with others based on work with Hermann Gluck, Denis de Turek, and Clayton Quayle and Shay Belavik, where we do this sort of, we derive a formula for triple linking number and try to apply to the this philosophy there. And it works, I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, there's some analytical difficulties, but they may be overcome eventually. So essentially, you can just put here not the usual linking number, but say signature of a knot or a triple linking number, right? Or something else you like, and ask if this works. And then, of course, the derivative, at the end of the day, you ask yourself, does it provide an energy bound? So I'll stop here because I believe I'm very badly over time. So.
So we were thinking about, I don't know whether it's scheduled, I checked this morning, of having a kind of a magenta session to discuss things related to this afternoon. And so I don't know if it's up yet, but I was thinking, in light of the time, take a couple of questions and maybe continue that discussion this afternoon. That's good.
Yeah, I'm happy to.
So for this limit to exist, you have to assume that the diffeo is volume reserving. If not, it's not.
This, well, actually, in principle, right? This is just topological in a sense. As long as you can show this limit exists everywhere and it's integrable, you're done. But in order to show it, sort of a helpful thing is ergodic theorem, which the action of by the group has to be measure preserving. So in this case, it's an action by the flows of these fields or of this field, and it has to be volume preserving in order to apply the theorem. But you can imagine sort of if you deform your field by some diffeomorphism and try to do this with respect to the original volume form, it should, in principle, there should be an invariant. I mean, or even. Well, there are these analytical difficulties which I mentioned.
And is it obvious, this is what you said, that the asymptotic linking number only depends on the flux and the topology of the tube? Because it's surprising to me that you have
so
flow on a tube.
Right.
You define the asymptotic linking number.
Okay, so it really the
it depends on the flux and the topology of the.
No, this is not quite true. So the full formula takes into account self-linkings of the tube as well, and that's what Ransom may tell more details. I mean, if you have something like two tubes like this, so generally, if you take helicity of the. If these fields are nice parallel circles, then you can conclude there's linking number times product of fluxes. But if these fields are, for instance, twisting around its core, then you get actually like a sum, right, of self-linking numbers. I mean, it's like a bilinear form. So it's a product of fluxes, bi flux bj, times sort of self-linking of a configuration. So if you look at this Carnot invariant, so more or less like how much twists around that. So there is this contribution as well. It only vanishes if this field is trivial inside the tubes. So from the perspective of the energy relaxation, that's kind of what it's like an extremal case. That's what you want to know, that even though the field is very simple, not only kind of globally linked, it still have energy there, right?
If the field is galactic, where you could have infinitely many tubes inside the tube, who knows what this would be correct?
I don't think there's such formula. No, but I think you just use the Arnold's approach in restriction to these tubes, and in principle, if there is such an invariant set inside, and the field itself is integrable, then you should have a quantity. The question if it's a type of a series like this, flux products of fluxes times something, and it converges, that I don't think has been tried. Outside should something should exist. But.
I have one question that's sort of maybe some of the books here, so sort of a Fourier transform of this. If I expand such a field as a combination series of curl eigenfields and try to then see how the coefficients vary.
I don't think that's one thing which actually I tried myself at some point, and I don't think anybody knows what happens to these coefficients. Actually, the problem is that if you do this expansion and you start acting by volume-preserving diffeomorphisms, there is no way to I don't think there's any way to control what happens to these coefficients.
But they give you, in some sense,
Helicity. Right, so helicity will have a nice sort of a series formula in this case, because what you get, if you expand, you have coefficients on the field, then you just do this L2 inner product. So what you're doing, you're scaling each coefficient by an eigenvalue, and you just take a sum, right? That's what, and for some reason, this stays invariant as you change these coefficients.
For this afternoon. So I noticed that a couple of them, check how long Mike Friedman wandered in. This afternoon we're going to have a magenta session, or just sort of more less formal, more informal discussion. So join us too then.
Well, thanks, yeah, I mean, what I saw with Michael was great.
we're running a little late. We're going to take a break for a couple of minutes, and then John Eppenheyer is going to continue the sort of morning session on this. So.
Yeah, in the meantime, I'll just show something for fun, maybe, while people are leaving.
One question. There's a slide about topological contributions in skin fields. So it's supposed to be closed on fields, it's more like a step.
This is Arnold's conjecture, right? This is Arnold's conjecture. It's only proven for things like vector fields based on braids in tubes. So if you have a diffeomorphism of a two disk, and you kind of look at the associated flow, then, and of course you can act on this diffeomorphism by diffeomorphism of disk area preserving, and look at these fields, then if this action is just by homeomorphism, helicity is invariant for those family of corresponding fields. Maybe I'm not making much sense, but this is kind of like a reduction of a problem to two dimensions, more or less. Then the answer is yes. And this has been proven by people like Jis and Gombaud.
Why isn't it true in general? Because
this is an open problem, because, well, nobody knows how to define helicity without using differentiability. That's one question.
When I use the formula that's underneath the screen, where you integrate all for all initial starting points and then you follow.
Yes, but I've been averaging. This is an averaging of a certain scalar function on the domain, and I've been averaging function obtained by contracting this Gauss form with two fields. And there's all, of course, fields are, form is, how do you define this for if you don't have tangent vectors, right? You have to have tangent vectors to put into the form to get a function.
No, maybe I don't understand. I thought the Arnold's conjecture was that the two fields are both smooth.
Yeah.
It's merely the conjugation between those biomorphisms.
That's right. Yeah, that's perhaps right.
Each one separately, you can do the analysis and you can evaluate the linking form, the self-linking form.
Right. Right.
So that integral is fine. And now, what I was proposing, and this is naive, I'm probably forgetting what the difficulty is, but you know, Arnold showed that the helicity integral is the same as the asymptotic integral.
Sure.
And no assumption about that. Is it periodicity necessary? Because I'm presuming we integrate.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Charging points as well. So that's like the first theorem in this paper, right?
Right. Right.
So, but now intuitively the linking number formulation, asymptotic linking number formulation looks like it only needs topological information.
These here that you wrote, it's only a theorem.
Because each, you know, each instance that you're integrating over is an integer, right?
Sure.
Number between these two trajectories.
Sure.
So that doesn't require smoothness. It's going to be defined almost everywhere for the usual reasons, I guess.
Right. Let me.
So is this true for a polynomial?
But
it seems that it's true the first line of this.
No. So let me think about it. So here's where the details I've hidden are not exposed. So things like this contribution from these short paths, etc. That has to be controlled, right? So you have to show that. Essentially, what I'm doing here, I assume that if I act by a volume-preserving deformation, I still can write down this function. So I can just contract. I'm averaging some function which is smooth essentially away from a diagonal. So and then the contribution from short paths goes to zero, and that uses this fact. You have to bound these integrals there in some way, and this uses the fact that you have some differentiability in those fields. I mean, you have to use, there are some details here which are swapped under the. I can try to explain on the paper maybe. And I think that this is not gonna go through with just action by homeomorphism. That's what I think. I'm sorry. What do I do?
Actually, a quick question just before John starts. Do you know if the eigenfields, the higher eigenvalue eigenfields are curled on the round free sphere?
Yes.
Are all cyclic vibrations?
I don't know this. I know that there's a guy, his name is Jason Cantarella. He computed these things for a three-sphere. Actually, expanded all curl eigenfields in a basis of just Hopf fields, and he wrote down explicit formulas. I don't know if he actually
it's more succinctly, the question is if a vector field is a eigenfield for curl on the round sphere,
yes,
all the orbits closed.
I don't know this. I don't know the answer to this. Perhaps. I would imagine that. These eigenvalues have multiplicities. So if you start looking at linear combinations of these fields, you can, I think, produce something which is not ciphered fiber.
That sounds
right. Yeah. So right. Sorry, John.
So it's a pleasure to
introduce John Ettenier from Georgia Tech, who I think is going to talk about, it was TBA earlier, but contact geometry and open books. And
that's right. So I did try to fix that TBA last night, but then they don't have access to the wiki, so to change it. So anyway, but yes, I'm going to talk about contact structures and open books, but I guess before I start, I really should thank the organizers. Right here this last week, I've been finding a lot of new places where fiber dots and contact geometry and so on show up, and I'm looking forward to hopefully understanding it enough to remember for more than a few days by the end of next week. I had originally planned on talking about the relationship between, or connections between contact geometry and metrics that have a lot of relations with fluid mechanics and the stuff that Rapal was just talking about. But after getting here, it seemed like this discussion of kind of open books and contact geometry might be more interesting to some people. So that's what I'm gonna do today. And our Magenta session was kind of conceived yesterday about 5 o'clock as I was leaving to maybe talk about these kind of connections through Riemannian geometry and contact structure. So
let me just pause for a second. So there's a variety of discussions that might happen.
Sorry, I'll say something about that after John's talk, if that's okay.
Certainly. Or
now,
if that works better.
Well, we thought that because one of the reasons we want to get these Magenta sessions in this afternoon is because quite a number of people are leaving at the end of this week. So this is one that I think that Rob and Rafael and John are talking about, which will be about, I don't know, combining contact geometry together with these fluid mechanical structures. But then Ivan and I have been talking about having a separate one in a location that we will try to fix, but we'll meet in this coffee area after lunch at 2 o'clock on trying to use knotted electromagnetic fields to try and imprint structures into knotted soft matter systems. So that they're probably, well, there'll be a small or almost zero overlap between these two sessions, maybe one more on the physics side and one maybe on the more mathematical side this afternoon. Mainly because I guess Daniel and Ivan are both going to be not here after today.
Okay, great.